Hello and welcome to the third episode of our podcast series on the methods for enhancing security in a construction contract. My name is Gwilym Evans and I'm a senior associate at Deems & Bolton, and I'm joined today by Lauren Melnick, an associate in the construction engineering team. In this episode, we'll be looking at guarantees and also briefly letters of reliance, how they work, their practical uses. But before we get stuck into those topics, Lauren, can you quickly explain to the listeners what we mean of by enhanced security?
Sure, thanks, Gwilym. So by security, we're really talking about performance security and those extra steps that a party entering a contract can take to help reduce the risk exposure they may face should the other side not perform. Some examples of such steps involve obtaining guarantees and letters of reliance.
Great. And for the benefit of listeners, the party who gives the guarantee is referred to as the guarantor, and the party to whom the promise or guarantee is given is referred to as the beneficiary.
Yes, exactly. And a key factor in understanding guarantees and how they compare to other forms of security is to appreciate that in English law, there is a legal distinction between what we call a primary obligation. The obligation in the building contract to make payment is one example, while the obligation in most guarantees is classed as a secondary obligation.
Yes, and the problem there in a nutshell is that because a true, in inverted commas, guarantee is a secondary obligation, it means that if the primary obligation ceases to exist for any reason, the guarantor cannot be held liable for it because the guarantee was dependent on the primary obligation existing. And obviously that would undermine the point of a guarantee, as it may become useless if the primary obliger has, for example, been dissolved through insolvency. And that's why bonds and indemnities, which are covered in other episodes on this series, are often preferred to guarantees, because in English law, those types of agreements or obligations are treated as if they were primary obligations.
Yeah, that's right. And that's also why, as lawyers acting for a beneficiary, we will seek to amend any guarantee in such a way that a future court would treat it as giving rise to a primary obligation.
Yes. Now, broadly speaking, there are two types of guarantees most commonly encountered in construction: parent company guarantees and individual guarantees. Lauren, could you summarise the first of these?
Yes. So a parent company guarantee is provided by the contractor's parent or ultimate holding company to the employer. If the contractor is then in default of the underlying contract, the employer can call upon the parent to remedy the breach, be it completing the works or paying sums due, as the case may be. Now, the guaranteeing parent's obligations are secondary and are contingent on the underlying contract, and therefore the party looking to rely on the guarantee must establish a liability under the underlying contract, unless, as just mentioned, the guarantee has been drafted to include a standalone indemnity. Parent company guarantees are typically required on international projects where the local entity, the subsidiary, lacks capitalization or reputation, and they're used to relieve any concerns in that regard.
Yes, and as you may imagine, individual guarantees are those given by an individual in their personal capacity, which means it's specific to that individual. In most situations, you'll find it's a director or potentially a partner of the commercial entity who is the party to the main building contract. But there are some legal principles which apply to guarantees provided by individuals, which are slightly different to those of, for example, a parent company guarantee. These include that the individual concerned needs to have entered the guarantee agreement free of undue influence, which, for example, might exist where the person giving the guarantee is a close family member of a person for whom the construction works are being done or who is otherwise deriving a benefit from the construction agreement. Also, because they're acting as an individual, it's possible that the terms of the agreement would be caught by the unfair contract terms if the individual is entering to it not as part of their general business or profession. Lauren, could you take us through some of the advantages of guarantees?
Absolutely. So we'll just give a flavour here of some of the advantages. So one, it is inexpensive. Secondly, it is available to both the employer and the contractor. Also, almost anyone can be a guarantor, like you've just said, Gwilym, including an individual. Fourthly, it creates incentive for the guarantor to use its influence to steer the primary obliger to fulfill their obligations. And also, depending on the circumstances, it can be a demonstration of good faith and confidence in the project that the guarantor is willing to take on a direct risk. And lastly, usually there's more freedom for terms to be tailored to suit the risk appetite of the parties so that only specific risk events are covered, or there may be certain caps or exclusions built into the guarantee.
Thanks, Lauren. Yes, it's less direction by standard form documents and more freedom for the parties to agree what they want to do. However, there are warnings on guarantees. The first is possibly quite self-evident. The guarantee is only as good as the party providing it, meaning you have the same due diligence activities required as you would for the main contracting entity. And furthermore, you will need to consider the location of the guarantor and their assets in the event that you do need to enforce the guarantee and recover from them. Secondly, varying the underlying agreement to which the guarantee has been provided, the primary obligation instrument, could inadvertently release the guarantor from their obligation. Care must be taken to ensure that any changes to the underlying contract does not jeopardize the guarantee, which in the context of construction is very important as programs and specifications are often subject to changes. Thirdly, there can be a lack of clarity of when the guarantee ends. And so it's normal to have to agree a predefined moment in time when the guarantee needs to come to an end. Often it's linked to practical completion. Fourthly, there can be issues as to what happens if an individual guarantor dies or becomes mentally incapable during the course of the guarantee, or there's questions as to their mental capacity at the time the guarantee was given. I hark back to what we said about undue influence. And fifthly, the circumstances in which the guarantee may be set aside is slightly wider. There might be issues to do with breach of contract, duty to disclose, and loss of security. It is for this reason that care must be taken when wording the guarantee to ensure it would continue to be capable of being relied upon. A well-drafted guarantee should cater for most situations, including being drafted in such a manner that the guarantor is clear that they are having a primary obligation, therefore primary liability, often including an indemnity, which is capable of being enforced as the primary obligation. Now, before we wrap up, we did say we would briefly touch on letters of reliance. Lauren, can you tell us what we're discussing when we say letters of reliance?
Absolutely, yes. So I did actually briefly mention letters of reliance in the first episode of this series, but we'll go into just a little bit more detail here. So a letter of reliance is a document usually provided by a consultant working on a project in favour of an interested third party. So it is usually provided in the context that the consultant has produced a report or series of findings upon which other key decisions have been based. Now, it provides an ability for the interested third party to have a direct contractual right in relation to the report. For example, a report stating that the land upon which construction of a residential property is to be built is free from contamination. Should the findings in the report prove to be incorrect, the original employer can bring a claim under the terms of the appointment to recuperate the losses suffered, but ordinarily an interested third party could not. So the letter of reliance will therefore identify the report which has been produced and project which it is being used for, and contain an acknowledgement from the consultant or surveyor that the party to whom the letter is addressed may rely on the contents of that report as if they had been the employer. So in essence, the consultant is providing a guarantee to the third party beneficiary that the content of the report can be relied upon.
Thanks. And I'd just like to add there that a letter of reliance can be as long or short as is required by the circumstances. It can also be made to include quite complex principles, things such as copyright licenses, professional indemnity insurance requirements, and rights to assign as is required.
Yes, great. So with that, Willem, I think we're at the end of this episode. So thank you.
Yes, and our next episode will be looking at types of insurance. Thank you to those listening today. You can find more information plus our previous podcast series on the construction page at the Stevens & Bolton website. And if you have any questions on today's topics, please don't hesitate to get in touch with any members of the Stevens & Bolton construction engineering team.